Morning, Sia.
Hi, Sia. How are you treating?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm fine.
You're just jealous, Richard.
I'm a bit sorry.
We're
recording in
sure
progress.
We have a quorum, members. Our apologies to start late. The chairperson has apologized. He'll be joining the meeting a bit later. He's attending the intelligence committee today. So we're therefore duty bound to call upon and we nominate an acting chair for this meeting. Can I then proceed to ask for nominations? I can't see hands. Mr. Romano, do you mind removing the...
Honorable
Neva Drachen's
hand is up
here.
Honorable Neva
Drachen. Okay, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Sia. In the absence of the chairperson, I would like to nominate Honorable Janki to be the acting chair until the chairperson comes back. Thank you.
Noted. Any further nominations? Am I audible, members?
You are, but you need a seconder.
Oh, yes. My apologies.
My hand is up. You must look to the screen, see? Yeah.
Okay.
I, Linda Moult, agree. I support it.
Okay. Thank you. Any further nominations? Okay, in the absence of any further nominations, I therefore call upon Honorable Janki to chair the meeting. He is duly elected. Thank you.
Well done, yeah.
Thank you very much, Sia and Honorable Members. It's now already 36 minutes to 10. Thank you for that. I see also it's been supported by Glennis as well. So can we start our meeting? Honorable Breitenbach did support that, just to be on record. Sia, can we get straight to it in terms of the first items that we must attend to? Which item do we start with?
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Colleagues from the department are here. We were going to get the briefing with the Land Courts Bill first, and then we deal with the other two bills. I'm not sure who's leading the delegation, Chair. Thank you.
All right. We don't have anything on information regulator today.
No, Chair. We will deal with that on Friday.
All right. Let's invite the department, therefore, who's leading the department on the briefing on the Land Court Bill.
Thank you, Chair.
Can we see you? Who's that? Can we see you, please?
Okay, can you see me, Chair?
It's dark, so you're in a hole, so you can't see you. Are you representing the department on this matter?
Yeah, but can you see?
Well, we can't see you. Maybe
can you see me?
We can't see you. Maybe you can continue speaking.
Chair, my name is Teresa Rose. I'm trying, I wonder if you can see me from your side.
Now we can see you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. My name is Teresa Ross, and the committee will be receiving a briefing, amongst others, on the Land Court Bill. Just as a way of background, Chair, the bill establishes a land court as a superior court and as a court of law and equity, and that court will hear land Chair, I wonder if Sia can put the slide. No, but just before the slide, because okay. Sorry, Sia. As a background, the court will hear land-related matters. Currently, Chair, the jurisdiction on land-related matters is scattered in a number of matters, a number of statutes, and it's in the Restitution of Land Rights Act, and which establishes the Land Claims Court. And in some cases, this court also shares jurisdiction with the Magistrates Court. So this bill, it will streamline the jurisdiction in respect of land-related matters in order to bring them under the Land Court. Chair, a state law advisor from legislation development, Mr. Mac Makubele, will take the committee through the actual presentation to give detail on what I've just said. And may I just mention that Ms. Lisa Naidu, who is the state law advisor who certified the bill, is also in attendance. Yeah, from the Office of the State Law Advisor. Thank you, Chair, and over to you, Mac.
Thank you. Where is Mac? We're waiting for Mac Makubele.
Chair, I can hear him from where I'm sitting, but I can see someone has just gone out to check what is happening. But I can hear him speak from where I'm sitting. So it could just be a technological challenge that he's having.
He's speaking to himself, not to us.
Thank you, Teresa. Good morning, Chair and Honorable Members. Can you hear me now?
You're now speaking to us, yes.
Thank you. My apologies for that glitch. My senior, Teresa Ross, has already introduced me by way of introduction. My name is Makubele and my surname is Mukudubete. It is an honor and a privilege to be presenting this bill to you this morning. Mr. Reza Ross has touched on a brief background on the quest for the establishment of the Land Court Bill. We have been, as the department, been mandated by the Interministerial Committee on Agriculture and Land Reform. Chair, can I ask that the slide be put up by the Secretariat?
Yes, it was put up for you. They can do that again.
It was. If it can be put up, I will remain on the slide 2, where we are dealing with the background. And if I may continue in the meantime, this interministerial committee has mandated us as the department to establish this a court that with the jurisdiction to deal with matters that are currently being dealt with by the Land Claims Court, as indicated by my colleague. Can we go back to slide 1? Slide 2 is that? And our mandate, Chair and Honourable Members, was to widen the mandate of this newly to be established a court to adjudicate on other matters that are land related. So we are not going to be confined to dealing with the matters that are only dealt with by the Land Claims Court. The existing Land Claims Court, Chair, is being established in terms of the Restitution of Land Rights Act, and it has the jurisdiction and power in respect of matters relating to land and most especially to restitution claims arising from that act. I must mention, Chair, it, the Land Claims Court shares concurrent jurisdiction with other courts in relation to the extension of the Security of Tenure Act, that is commonly known as ESTA, and the Land Reform Labor Tenants Act, which is commonly known as the Labor Tenants Act. Now, Chair, the Land Claims Court as it currently exists has experienced some challenges, especially in relation to the lack of permanency of the judges and also the lack of permanency of the court. That is, the Land Claims Court is not a permanent court on its own. So now this contributed, that is the problem, the challenges that have been experienced by the Land Claims Court, they contributed to the slow processing of and the backlogs in the land restitution claims, and this resulted in the dissatisfaction of the land claimants due to the slow process of finalizing their matters. If I may go to the next slide, Chair. That slide deals with the aims of the bill, that is the land court bill, which are in the first instance to establish a land court with jurisdiction to grant any order, any other appropriate relief or impose any sanction. Secondly, to establish a land court of appeal to hear and determine appeals emanating from the judgment of the land court, and thirdly, Chair, to provide for court ordered mediation or arbitration. Here, Chair, we are establishing a dispute resolution mechanism, which will be in the form of mediation or arbitration. Chair, as my colleague Ms. Ross has mentioned earlier on, the land court is established as a law of equity, as a court of law and equity, and it will have a status similar to that of the high courts that are established in terms of the Superior Courts Act. In addition, Chair, the court will consist of the judge president, the deputy judge president, and so many other judges as may be determined by the president of the republic. Chair, on to the next slide. We are dealing with the seal and the jurisdiction of the court, of the court, and this is contained in Chapter 2 of the bill. We are saying, Chair, there that the court, that is the land court, will have a seal of a design that will be determined by the President of the Republic, and this will be by way of a proclamation in the Gazette. And the custody of that seal, Chair, will be kept by the Registrar of the Land Court. The seat of the court will be in Johannesburg. However, due to expediency or in the interest of justice, the judge president can determine that the sitting of the court be held elsewhere. Now, Chair, the next sentence is incomplete, and for that I apologize. It should read, the court will have exclusive jurisdiction in respect of all matters that in terms of this bill or in terms of any other law are to be determined by the court. So it will be, the sentence is incomplete, as it says, the matters are determined by the court. So I do apologize for that. So if I may continue, the minister will be given the powers after consultation with the Chief Justice, to define a specific area of jurisdiction of each court, and may increase or decrease or reduce its area of jurisdiction. Chair, the next slide deals with the appointment of judges, officers and assessors, and this is contained in Chapter 3 of the bill, where we are saying, Chair, the President, on the advice of the Judicial Service Commission, is empowered to appoint the judge president and the deputy judge president of the court. And these judges must be judges of the High Court and must also have knowledge and experience and expertise in the field of land rights matters. The president of the Republic Chair, on the advice of the JSC, and the judge president of the court may appoint as many judges as is necessary as judges of the court. But those appointed must be judges of the High Court, and at least half of those must have been judges on appointment and have expertise in land rights matters and be gender representative. In addition, Chair, the Minister is empowered to make acting appointments in the office of the Deputy Judge President or a judge of the Land Court. Chair, the next slide, we're still dealing with the appointment of judges, where we are saying a judge holds office until they are discharged from active service and may resign by giving a written notice to the President of the Republic. The tenure of office, remuneration, and the terms and conditions of service applicable to a judge of the High Court are not affected by the appointment or concurrent tenure of office of that judge who is appointed as a judge of the court. Now, Chair, Clause 10 deals with the issue of a process against the judges of the court. We are saying that, Chair, no process is to be issued against the judge president, the deputy judge president, or judge of a court, except with consent of the court. This is contained in Clause 10 of the bill. However, Chair and the Honourable Members will recall that when this committee was dealing with the amendment to the Domestic Violence Act, there was a consequential amendment that has been made to amend Section 47 of the Superior Courts Act, to make sure that there is no need or the consent of the court will not be required if the judge of the court is subpoenaed or is a process is served against the judge in relation to the matters arising out of the application of the Domestic Violence Act. So as a result, Chair, we have put an exception in that clause 10 to read as follows: except for an application made in terms of the Domestic Violence Act, no civil proceedings by way of summons or notice of motion may be instituted against the judge president, deputy judge president, or any judge of the court. So what we did there is to ensure that the bill will contain a provision that will align with the Superior Courts as amended by the Domestic Violence Amendment Act. So continuing on the slide 6, the minister is empowered to appoint a manager, assistant managers, a registrar, assistant registrars, and other officials of the court who are appointed in terms of the law governing public services. However, Chair, you will notice in the bill we are making a provision that the minister can delegate these powers to appoint to the Secretary General of the Office of the Chief Justice. This will align with a provision in the Superior Courts Act, specifically Section 11.4, in terms of which the minister's powers to appoint can be delegated to the Secretary General of the Office of the Chief Justice. Chair, we have a provision to the effect that the court may sit with or without assessors, to assist the court, more especially in contested hearings. However, I must add, Chair, that not more than two assessors can be appointed to sit with the court in any particular case. Chair, on slide 7, we are dealing with chapter 4, particularly with the institution of proceedings, where a clause 13 deals with the locus standi for a person who can bring an who can bring the proceedings before the court. And in particular, we are giving a locus standi to the Commission on the Restitution of Land Rights Act, of land rights as established in terms of the Restitution of Land Rights Act. Also, a person acting in their own right or on behalf of another person can institute proceedings in a court. Any person acting as a member of or in the interest of a group or a class of persons, any person acting in the public interest or any association acting in the interest of its members. Chair and honorable members, a person who wishes to institute proceedings in the court is required to notify the registrar of an intention to do so, and the registrar must then refer the matter to the judge president, who will in turn have to decide whether the matter must be heard in the court or must be referred for mediation or arbitration. So if the matter has to go to for mediation or arbitration, the judge president must make a specific order directing the registrar to transfer the matter to the mediator or the arbitrator. On to the next slide, 8, Chair. We're making a provision for the rules of court and the legal representation, where we are making a statement that the provisions of the superior courts and the uniform rules apply to the court unless other provision has been made in the regulations. So I must add specifically here, Chair, that the rules board for courts of law is the body that will be making the rules for the court, as it is the one that has developed the uniform rules of court. Chair, any person may apply for leave to appeal to intervene in the proceedings before the main court. In addition, a person may self-represent or may be legally represented by a legal practitioner, but this will be at their own cost. However, Chair, if the party cannot afford legal representation, and if it is in the interest of that party to be legally represented, the court must then refer the matter to legal aid to consider granting legal representation at the state expense. So the expenditure relating to legal aid will be defrayed from the money that will be appropriated by Parliament for this purpose. So currently there's this land rights management facility that is currently managing the funds that are made available for the provision of legal aid, specifically in land-related matters. Chair, on to slide 9. Clause 19 slide 9 deals with the provision for the manner of securing the attendance of witnesses, refusal to give evidence, witness fees, the taking of evidence of a person who resides or who is outside the area of jurisdiction of the court. So in addition, we are providing in the bill that certain rules of evidence are relaxed so as to empower the court to admit evidence, including oral evidence, which it considers relevant and cogent to the matter being heard by it, whether or not such evidence will be admissible in any other court. In short, Chair, we are saying this court is entitled to hear, for instance, hearsay evidence, even if that hearsay evidence will not have been admitted in any other court of law. Chair, the Land Court will have all such powers that a division of the High Court will have in, or have currently in civil proceedings. However, if the court considered it to be in the interest of justice, it may decide any issue in terms of any other law which is not ordinarily within its jurisdiction, but is incidental to an issue within its jurisdiction. Chair, on to the next page of slide 11. We are dealing with the court orders, variation, rescission, and costs, where we are saying, Chair, the court may at any stage, if it becomes apparent that a dispute should have, in the first place, been referred for mediation or arbitration, the court may stay the proceedings and refer the dispute to mediation or arbitration. This is contained in clause 24-28 of the bill, Chair. In addition, Chair, the court may, of its own accord or on application of any affected party, vary or rescind its decision, judgment, or order. When granting costs, the court may consider whether the matter ought to have been referred to mediation or arbitration, and in addition, the conduct of the party during the proceedings. In addition, Chair, the court may order costs against a party to a dispute or against his or legal representative. Chair, the next slide deals with mediation and is contained in clause 31 of the bill. We are saying that in slide 11, that if at any stage of the proceedings, but just before judgment, it becomes evident to the court that there is any issue or dispute which might be resolved through mediation, the court may make an order directing the parties to attempt to settle the issue or dispute through mediation, and in that event, the court may stay the proceeding until that mediation process has been concluded. The judge president must make an order directing the registrar to transfer the matter to the mediator, then specify the time, the date, and the place where the process is to start, and to appoint a fit and proper person as a mediator. And the registrar then, Chair, must notify the parties of this transfer of the matter to mediation, and this will be done in a prescribed manner. That is, the regulation will prescribe the manner in which the registrar is going to notify the parties of the transfer of the matter to mediation. However, Chair, the parties may at any time during the mediation, by agreement, appoint another person to mediate the dispute. Chair, the discussions, the disclosures and submissions that are made during the mediation process are privileged unless the parties agree to the contrary. The next slide, Chair, deals with the arbitration as contained in clause 32 of the bill. The similar process, Chair, will be followed as the one that is contained in clause 31 dealing with mediation. That is, the court can refer the matter or can order the parties to attempt to settle the dispute through arbitration, and this will be as prescribed. And in that event, Chair, the court may stay the proceedings. Similarly, with mediation, the court will direct the registrar to transfer the matter, and then the court will stipulate, specify the time, the date, and the place where the process is to start, and we will also appoint a fit and proper person as arbitrator. Similarly, Chair, the parties are entitled, if they so wish to do, they can appoint another person to arbitrate the dispute. Then the registrar is required to transfer the matter and notify the parties of the transfer in the prescribed manner. The court may, on good cause shown by any party to the arbitration, at any time on application, stop the arbitration process and to proceed in the court or vary or set aside the settlement agreement. Chair, arbitration continues on to slide 13, where we are saying an arbitration award issued by an arbitrator is final and binding, and is as if it were an order of court in respect of which a writ has been issued. However, Chair, if a party fails to comply with an arbitration order, that order orders the performance of an act other than the payment of money, any party to the award may enforce such an award by instituting contempt of court proceedings in the court itself. However, if there's allegation of a defect in the arbitration and proceedings, a party to the dispute may apply to the court for the review of the arbitration award. Chair, if a matter is settled out of court, it can be either negotiation, mediation or arbitration, and that settlement agreement, Chair, is acceptable or is accepted by all the parties. The registrar must submit the settlement agreement to the court for confirmation or rejection. Upon receipt of this settlement agreement, Chair, the court must consider the agreement and confirm the agreement and make it an order of court, or may refer it back to the parties for consideration of any specific issues, or even reject the settlement agreement. But if the court rejects the settlement agreement, the matter must proceed in the court. Chair, on to slide 14, we are dealing with the Land Court of Appeal as contained in Chapter 5 of the Bill, where we are saying the Bill established the Land Court of Appeal as a court of law and equity, with the status equal to that of the Supreme Court of Appeal. Chair, we are saying the Land Court of Appeal, except the Constitutional Court, is the final court of appeal in respect of all the judgments and orders made by the Land Court, in respect, however, of the matters within its exclusive jurisdiction. The Land Court of Appeal will consist of the President, the Deputy President, and as many judges as may be necessary. It is constituted before any three judges who the President of the Republic designates from the panel of judges of the Land Court and the High Court. On to slide 15, Chair. The President of the, and we are continuing with the Land Court of Appeal, on slide 15, where we are saying, Chair, the President of the Republic acts on the advice of the JSC and after consultation with the Minister of Justice to appoint a President of the Land Court of Appeal and a Deputy President of the Land Court of Appeal, who may be judges of the Supreme Court of Appeal. That is the Chair, the President may take from the pool of the judges of the Supreme Court and then appoint from that pool the President of the Land Court of Appeal and the Deputy President of the Land Court of Appeal. The judges of the Land Court of Appeal are appointed by the President of the Republic, but on the advice of the JSC, after consultation with the Minister, the Chief Justice, and the Judge President of the Land Court of Appeal. However, the 18 judges, Chair, are appointed by the Minister after consulting the Chief Justice and the Judge President. The Deputy President of the Land Court of Appeal will act as the President of the Land Court of Appeal if the President of the Land Court of Appeal is unable to act in that office. Chair, the officers of the Land Court hold the corresponding office in relation to the Land Court of Appeal. On to the next slide, Chair, we are continuing finally with the Land Court of Appeal, where we are saying this court, subject to the Constitution, has exclusive jurisdiction to determine all appeals of matters emanating from the Land Court and to decide any question of law reserved in terms of Clause 25, 2A of the Bill. Chair, Clause 25 provides that the court or a party on application to the court, the court may reserve a question of law for the decision by the Land Court of Appeal. To continue further, Chair, an appeal from the Land Court, appeal to the Land Court of Appeal must be made with leave from the Land Court. However, if the Land Court refuses to grant leave, then it must be with leave of the Land Court of Appeal. A judgment of the Land Court, Chair, is Land Court of Appeal is binding on the Land Court. Is binding on the Land Court itself. Chair, on to the next slide. I must mention this is the second last slide, Chair, where we are briefly talking about the general provision. This is contained in slide 17. Chair, chapter 6 deals with the general provisions applicable to the courts established by the bill. This includes, Chair, matters relating to finances and accountability, transitional arrangements, amendment of laws as contained in the schedule, regulation, and the short title. Chair, before I proceed to the conclusion on to slide 18, I need to make a few remarks relating to the schedule that I referred to in slide 17. Chair will notice that at the back of the bill, we have a schedule that lists at least 9 pieces of legislation. Those pieces of legislation are intended to be placed within the jurisdiction of the Land Court immediately upon the establishment of the Land Court. That is, our intention was to say, because this Land Court is established anew, we are not going to place under its jurisdiction all the pieces of legislation that deals with land. Throughout the processing of this bill, Chair, we have established that there are at least about 33 pieces of legislation that deals with land. So our intention is not to include all 33 pieces of legislation under the jurisdiction of the court. So instead, we are going to follow an incremental approach in terms of which other pieces of legislation will in due course be placed under the jurisdiction of the court. So for starters, we are immediately including only 9 pieces of legislation under the jurisdiction of the court so that the court can deal with those pieces of legislation upon its establishment. Chair, in conclusion, I need to mention that the bill has been costed and the main financial implication that we have established through the costing process is that they will be in the form of additional human resources that relates to the appointment of judges, officers of the court, and the appointment of mediators and arbitrators who are not in the full-time employ of the state. Chair, this concludes my presentation, and I thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mokudubede. Any further brief additions, Ross?
Thanks, sir. That is the presentation. Thank you.
Welcome to the Deputy Minister. Before I invite you any comments, do you want to make any remarks, Deputy Minister?
Good morning, Acting Chair. No, I've come for the Sexual Offences Amendment Bill. I'm sure the officials are handling the Land Court Bill adequately. I missed the beginning. I had other meetings, so I don't really want to comment in case I'm repeating what has been said already. Thanks.
Thank you. Honourable Members, I now want to invite you. You sat and listened, read the Land Court Bill. I'm going to invite you to make your considered comments on this. I see the hand of Honourable Werner Owen. Any other hand except Werner? Then we'll have Glennis, you'll have Valma, Nivot, Drachen. You'll have Nomathemba, Maseko, Jele, in that order. Honourable Werner Horn.
Thank you, Honourable Kubukile Janki, the Acting Chair. yes, thank you, and thank you for the presentation. I have a few clarity-seeking questions. Firstly, regarding the as many judges as possible, is my understanding correct that ultimately this will be similar to the Special Tribunal of the SIUB, a position where judges who are serving in the different divisions of our High Court will be designated to serve at this court for some fixed periods? And have we, if that is the case, have we already looked into the, I want to say, the small issues that are creeping in at the SIU Special Tribunal, where the feedback is that, of course, specifically in respect of part-heard matters, it becomes an issue when a judge returns to his or her High Court, and then a further designation must be arranged with the judge president of that division. And that could lead to ultimately not speeding up matters, but rather delaying it. Then, Mr. Acting Chair, in respect of both mediation and arbitration, I would want to inquire and also suggest that we must supplement or further delineate what we mean with fit and proper persons who can act as mediators and arbitrators. I think it is too vague for specifically in the case of arbitration, people will make very important decisions. And then in respect of the statement or the clause, I think it's 33, indicating that, or 32 and onwards, firstly, that arbitration awards will be final and binding, although, if I understand it correctly, it will have to be approved by the court. What is the final and binding clause? What's the effect of that on the right of appeal, which litigants ordinarily would enjoy? I get the sense that in the event of an arbitration, there won't be necessarily a right of appeal. And have we considered whether that will pass constitutional muster, if that is indeed the intention behind the status of arbitration appeals which have been approved by the court? Thank you. That's at this stage everything, Mr. Acting Chair.
Thank you, Werner. Let's get them fresh. Let's get a response to that immediately, Mr. Mokudubede and Ross, so that you stay on top of it. There's no time for coffee. Responses?
Thank you, Chair.
Who starts?
Chair, I'll take the...
You push each other. Who starts?
Okay, Chair. Let me allow Mac to proceed, and then I'll, in case what I wanted to say he has not said, then I'll cover it up.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to Honourable Horn for the questions. We have noted, I've noted the submission as to the vagueness of the statement fit and proper person, and we will deal with that in due course, but the remark to an extent that this is vague, then we will attend to that. The issue of the arbitration being final and binding, the effect of that is that once the award has been handed down or issued, then it will be a binding, it is final and it will be a binding award. As much as it is the case, Chair, in relation to the judgment of the court, the judgment of the court is binding unless or until it has been set aside by the highest court. So in this instance, we are saying the award is binding, is final and binding between the parties. However, it can be taken on review if the party is not satisfied with that. But in as far as it is concerned between the parties, it is final and binding. Chair, as to the number of judges, we have a provision that the judge of the land court, upon appointment, and if that judge has to go to other duties in the other court, then that judge will still be regarded or be entitled to be regarded as the judge, and can in any event be allowed to come back and then conclude the matter that has been before that judge, and that matter has to be dealt with until finalization. So in short, the judge is entitled to come back to finalize the matter. We are bearing in mind, Chair, that the intention of the bill is to make sure that the matters of the matters relating to land are dealt with as speedily as possible. And that is why we are beefing up the land court with the number of judges that as may be necessary for appointment in the court, so as to expedite the matters that are before the court. So the appointment of the will be by the judge president to say how many judges are required for the purpose of dealing with matters. Say the judge president will be in a position to appoint enough number of judges to be able to deal with the backlog that we currently are faced with. I'm not sure if Teresa will want to add anything on that. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, Mr. Foss, just reposition yourself whilst you're breaking up a little bit, Mr. Mokodube. Mr. Ross, any additions?
Thank you, Chair. On that last issue, I'll just like to add on that last issue that Max spoke to, on the whether the designation of the judges and that was raised by Honorable Horn. The bill provides that the judges will be appointed to the court because the lack of permanency is one of the challenges that was stifling the operation of the land claims court. So the aim is to have some permanency in respect of the judges to the land court. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. If there are any follow-ups, we'll come to them at the end, Honorable Horn. I now invite Honorable Glenys Breytenbach. There was a presiding officer who was struggling to pronounce it, Breytenbach.
Thank you, Honorable Kubadile Janki.
I am covered largely by Honourable Horne's questions with regard to arbitration, and I too am concerned about the vagueness of the fit and proper requirement. Also, the section that refers to the ability of the court to rescind its own judgments at any time or bury them, I'd like a little more detail on that. That's a strange situation, and I find it strange. I'd like more information on it, please. Thank you.
Thank you. Mokotobede. On the rescission.
Thank you, Chair. The court is empowered to rescind its judgment. It can do that meromotu, that is of its own accord, or by way of an application to the court. By way of an application of a party to vary or rescind the judgment that has been handed down. Chair, the full details in relation to this clause will be beefed up or contained in the rules of the court, as they are the ones that are going to stipulate as to how the variation and application for rescission is going to be dealt with and under what circumstances. So what we are doing in here is to give the rules, the substantive provision that will enable the court to rescind a judgment. So the further details will be beefed up in the rules in relation to the process that will be followed. I hope I answered the question in full. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Velma Nivot.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you very much, Acting Chairperson, and just a moment. And thank you to the team for the presentation. I have a number of questions. So there's the Land Claims Court on the one hand, and then there's the Land Court on the other hand. If the Land Court is established, does the Land Claims Court get dissolved, or does it continue with its existence? Could you just clarify that, please? And if the Land Claims Court does continue to exist, then how do those two courts operate with each other? On slide 6, you said something about clause 10, and I wasn't clear of the explanation. So if you could clarify what you were saying about clause 10, no processes instituted against the judge president or something like that. If you could just clarify that again, please. And then you said the costing has been done for the bill, but then you also say that the seat of the court will be seated in Johannesburg, but can travel. So my clarification would be, you know, wherever the court has to travel, has that been costed? Because my concern is that when the people need to go to a court, they can't always afford to travel. You know, maybe they have to fly to Joburg even, because the distances are so great. So for the people who can't afford to go all the way to Johannesburg, will there be provision made for them in terms of transport assistance or anything like that? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. Mokotobedu and Ross, responses?
Thank you, Chair. If I may start with the last one. Chair, you will notice that in the bill we are making a provision that although the seat of the court is in Johannesburg, the court will have other seats in the in each of the division of the High Court. So it's not like, Chair, we are going to have one court as it currently is the case. So each and every division of the High Court, then there will be a land court that will enable the easy access to the court. In addition, Chair, I have indicated that the minister can be able to declare a specific area to be an area where the court can be held. That will enable the accessibility of the parties to the court. So in short, the parties will not have to go to the seat of the court in the province, because the minister will have declared a certain area, an area where the court can be established. In addition, Chair, there's a provision in the bill that says the judge president, and in the interest of justice and for expediency, can be able to determine a place where the sitting of the court can take place. For instance, Chair, if the school in a particular area can be used to hold the court for any particular case, and obviously subject to the beefing up of that school in terms of the equipment and all other essentials that are required for the establishment or the holding of the court, then the judge president is entitled to say that this particular case will be held at that school until it has been finalized. So it's not only the school, Chair, it could be a town hall, it could be any other public place which in the interest of justice, the judge president considers to be the appropriate place for the holding of the court. So in essence, we are trying to make sure that the court is not fixed at a certain place, but there is that flexibility of the holding of the court at any particular case, at any particular place. Chair, with regards to to clause 10, currently in terms of the High Court, or in terms of the Superior Courts Act, Section 47 provides that no process of courts can be issued against the judge of the court, including the judge president or the deputy judge president, unless the court has issued or given a consent. For instance, if I may make an example, if the judge is subpoenaed to appear in a certain court, then the subpoena cannot be issued without the consent being given by the judge president of the court where that judge is presiding. So if the judge to be subpoenaed should testify in Johannesburg, and that judge presides in a court in Johannesburg, then that judge, the issue, the subpoena or any document that requires attendance of that judge must be issued by the judge president before that process can be served or executed against the judge. Now, that was a glitch. There was a certain issue that happened in the, I think it was in the KwaZulu-Natal. As a result of, in that case, Chair, in short, the matter that relates to a domestic violence require the attendance of the judge, but because there was no consent given for the issuing of that process against that judge, then the matter had to be struck out because of that non-compliance. So you can understand, Chair, that how sensitive domestic violence is, and now the matter had to be struck off because of non-compliance with that provision. So we are saying, and this is what has been said before, this has served before this committee when we dealt with the amendment to the domestic violence. We said that Section 47 of the Superior Court Act has to be amended so as to make sure that in the matters relating to domestic violence, then there is the requirement of the consent being given by the judge president should not apply in the domestic violence related matters. That is a nutshell. I just hope that I have successfully clarified the matter, but I'll hear from the members. Chair, the Land Claims Court, the Land Claims Court, as it currently stands, has got its own challenges. And now, in order to cure or to rectify those challenges, we are saying we are going to get rid of that court, establish a new court, because you'll remember, Chair, the Land Claims Court is established in terms of the Restitution of Land Rights Act. We are saying we are going to establish a land court through its own legislation. So we are going to take it out of the Restitution Act, and then we are establishing it under its own legislation, and that is going to replace the existing Land Claims Court. So we are not going to ultimately have the Land Claims Court running parallel to the Land Court. All the matters that are dealt with in the Land Court are going to be transferred or dealt with in the Land Court. There are other provisions that are dealing with instances where the matters are dealt with elsewhere. We are making a provision for that, or maybe then in the other courts. Remember, Chair, we are saying once the bill is promulgated, the Land Court will be established, and then it will deal with all those nine pieces of legislation. At that point, Chair, it stands to reason that there will be other matters dealing with, or maybe then emanating from those pieces of legislation that are being dealt with elsewhere in the High Courts or in the Magistrate Courts. So we have a provision in the Land Court Bill to say that the matters that are dealt with in the other High Courts, they are dealing with maybe then a specific piece of legislation that relates to land. Those matters are going to be continued in the High Court or the Magistrate Court until they have been finalized, as if the Land Court Bill has not been promulgated. However, upon the promulgation of the Land Court Bill, all the Land Claims Court matters will be transferred and dealt with in the Land Court, so as to permanently get rid of the Land Claims Court. That is what we are doing, and I hope I've clarified that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Noma Themba Maseko Jele.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to welcome the presentation. I think the long-awaited presentation by the country, in particular in resolving these, helping to resolve the issues of the land claims, Chairperson. But however, I just want to ask the department, in 2019, the Constitutional Court raised some concerns about the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. I'm not going to quote everything, but in short, I would pick up some words in the words of the court where it says, it is not the concern, it is not the constitution, nor the courts, nor the laws of the country that are at fault in this. It is the constitutional incapacity of the department to do what the statutes and the constitution require of it that lies at the heart of the global crisis that it has been experienced at Chairperson. So I would want the department, maybe the presenters also, to comment on that one before we can even go further, Chairperson. So I have also two questions, Acting Chairperson. The other question is, how will the department ensure that there is a sufficient public awareness of this bill? And then lastly, we did hear previously, Chairperson, or rather Acting Chair, the department, the OCJ, giving us challenges in terms of transferring the functions from the Department of Justice to the OCJ. Now there is the whole issue is going to repeat itself. I would just want to know from the presenters, how are they going to make sure that there is a smooth transfer of functions from the Department of Land Reforms and the Rural Development to the Legal Aid South Africa, as well as the Department of Justice. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Mokudubete and Ross. Responses to that?
Thank you, Chair. And thank you to Honorable Masego Jelle for the questions. I will start with the last one, going upwards. Chair, throughout the processing of this this bill, we have been in engagement with various stakeholders that are involved or that are affected by what we are doing. And particularly the legal aid, the land rights management facility, and obviously then the Department of Agriculture, because the Land Rights Management Facility falls under its administration. So we have been making engagements and in a way that will see to the smooth transition of the taking over of the function. So it's not like, Chair, we are going to wait until the bill is promulgated. So the processes are still being undertaken. The engagements are being made. The costing of the entire process is underway from the side of the legal aid itself to ensure that they are capacitated to be able to deal with land matters. So in short, Chair, we are not waiting until the publication. The processes are still, have actually kick-started to make sure that upon the commencement of the bill, that everything will be in place. And Chair, you will recall that in terms of the commencement clause of the bill, we will be targeting the commencement to ensure that when the bill commences, everything that needs to be done is in place, including the regulation. This transfer will have to be in place, and we will make sure that it is done so that there will be that smooth transition. The public awareness chair, the department has got a way of dealing with the awareness of any piece of legislation, including the amendments. That is done with the in collaboration with the Department of Communication, that is entrusted with the mandate of communicating to the public of what is being done by government. And so there will be that communication drive that will be undertaken to ensure that people are aware of the developments on the land space. In addition, Chair, the department or the officials of the department in various areas of the matters or of the legislation dealt with or administered by the department, they are normally or frequently, I must add, called to do the interviews in relation to specific pieces of legislation. That will be radio interviews, and these are done through the local radios, radio stations, where the officials are called or invited to brief the nation on certain areas of the law that have developed, or new developments or amendments in certain areas of the law, particularly the laws that are administered by the department. So there are communication drives that are currently in place, and that will be taken care of. Chair, the Constitutional Court judgment, I don't know if other colleagues of mine will be able to assist me. I'm not sure of this judgment, but from what I gather from the extract read by Honorable Maseko Jelly, my take will be that we will recall when the Land Claims Court was established, it was established on a basis that this court will not be a permanent court. It will have a short lifespan to deal with restitution matters. And there was a miscalculation in a sense that it was thought this restitution will be a shorter process, only to find that it became worse than what it was anticipated. The matters became so many that it resulted in backlogs to an extent that the something had to be done to cure that problem. So now, what we are doing here is at least to try to deal with that predicament, particularly the lifespan that was created or the establishment of the Land Claims Court for a specific time frame. So we are going to replace that. The Land Court is going to be administered by the Department of Justice. The provisions that deal with the Land Claims Court in the Restitution Act are going to be repealed through this land court bill, so that everything that deals with court will be dealt with in the land court. And the court will be established as a permanent court with various places where the court can sit, so as to make sure that there are no glitches that have been experienced due to the establishment of the Land Claims Court for a specific lifespan. I just hope, Chair, I have answered that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, colleagues. We're going to do this now. If you have any follow-ups, I'll take brief follow-ups and then ask a final response and the Deputy Minister if he wants to. And also welcome the Chair and then at that point hand over the meeting back to the Chair. Any follow-ups? Quick ones. Honourable Velma Nivold.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the responses to my question. And thank you for especially the explanation with regards to the Land Claims Court. But it's not really a question, but I'm raising a concern. The backlog as experienced by the Land Claims Court, I'm worried that if the new established land court, you know, after the bill has been passed, it's been established, the backlogs will in actual fact then, you know, be transferred. I have family members who have been impacted by the land claims, and they're struggling and it hasn't been resolved. So I'm hoping that the land court will speed up any backlogs left by the Land Claims Court, so that there's a resolution in terms of all the backlog cases. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. That's the only follow-up. We'll go back to you, Mokudubele, and then after you, the Deputy Minister can any comments, if there are any. And at that point, we'll hand over to the Chairperson.
Well, thank you, Chair, and thank you to Honourable Velma about the concern raised. And the short answer will be that the Land Court Bill establishes is intended to establish the Land Court to actually get rid of those backlogs. Remember, they have the backlogs occurred as a result of the a lack of permanent judges. Some judges were seconded, and not enough judges were available to deal with all those deadlocks, and also the permanency of the court. So what we are doing is to say that there will be enough number of the judges, and that those numbers will be determined. I don't want to preempt the Chair at this stage as to how that is going to be done, but the intention is to make sure that there will be enough number of judges that will deal with the backlogs that currently exist, and to be able to make sure that the other matters can be dealt with smoothly. So the court will be capacitated sufficiently to be able to deal with the backlogs. That's my short response that I can give at this stage. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Deputy Minister, any word?
Chair, no, thanks very much. Look, this is an important bill, and we hope that the establishment of a land court will address a number of the problems that have been experienced with the adjudication process. So we're excited about the bill. I would just also point out to the committee that because of the urgency of the bill was not subjected to public comment before it came to Parliament. Usually we will try and do that. So when you advertise it for public comment, just remember this is the first time that people are going to be engaging with this bill. So you just need to factor that issue in. But Chair, no, thanks. That's all I would want to say at this point.
Thank you. Thank you to the team. Thank you, members.
Sorry, I haven't supported a coup, Acting Chair.
Come again?
No, I called you Chair. And I just because the real Chair is here, I didn't want to be seen to be supporting a coup. So I corrected myself to say acting chair.
No, you are late. You don't know how we elected the chair, so please step back. I now want to invite Chairperson Mogwanishi to take over the next item. Honorable Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chair. You were duly elected. You are the chair. Thank you very much for.
And JJ is staging a coup, sir.
No, thank you very much. No, he's not. He's just trying to protect himself. Thank you very much, members, and good morning. We are still in this meeting of the JSCI. We might be called for a short time, even now, just to vote, maybe for 5 minutes or so. But I was concerned that we might finish the first and the second item as we agreed with Honorable Janji, who was the acting chair, that I would need to be available for the third and the fourth item. So I asked to be released, but I might be called just to go and vote for a few minutes and come back again. Thank you very much, Deputy Minister, for availing yourself. As usual, we do appreciate your availability. And members, I propose that we start with the sexual offences. I was informed that the Deputy Minister will be with us until 12 o'clock. He will be attending another meeting, briefing the NCOP, a select committee, after 12. So he asked to be released at 12. Is that still the position, Deputy Minister?
That is correct, Chair. They're dealing with the salary increases or non-salary increases for judges and magistrates. So I have to do the briefing I did for you.
Yes. No, thank you very much. Over to you. I would ask you to focus on the areas that were outstanding and not start the bill afresh because we had covered quite a lot of ground last week. So the areas that we were still outstanding that we had not yet covered, or we did cover but we did not conclude, can we take those matters so that we can move to the domestic violence bill?
Chair, can I just point off before? Can I just report to you, Chair, that I'm about to move from the village to the parliament. So at some point, maybe I'll switch off because I'll be traveling. Just okay. To let you know, Chair. Thank you.
That will be noted. Thank you very much. Honorable Chale, can you proceed, Mr. Dupris?
Good morning, Mr. Chairperson, Minister and members of the community. Chair, yes, you requested us just to focus on those outstanding issues. Actually, if my memory serves me correct, there is only two of them. The first one is on page 4 of our cleaned up document now, which deals with the definition of person who is vulnerable. Chair, I'm just interrupting myself. I would just like to confirm, can you see the document that I'm working on now on your screen?
Yes, you can see it, Mr. Dupris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the chairperson, the person who is vulnerable definition has been accepted, and the only issue that was still outstanding with regard to the definition is the whole issue of female persons under the age of 25 years. Before I pause here, Mr. Chair, I would just like to take you quickly through to the end of the document, because our definition of person who is vulnerable now also becomes relevant where there is the obligation to report sexual offences currently in respect of children and persons who are mentally disabled. The question was raised why you should keep that obligation as is and rather not, or the question was why couldn't we then extend the ambit of that obligation to include all persons who are vulnerable. And I've also highlighted that, and it's the proposed amendment to the proposed amendment to section 54 of the Act, where we refer to a person who is vulnerable as defined in section 40. With your permission, then, Mr. Chair, I will go back to page 4 for the discussion to take place by the members. And I conclude with that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I guess that members had time to reflect and digest the implications and the necessity of this particular section dealing with women under the age of 25. Can I now notice? I have Honorable Jale, is it a new hand or an old hand?
I will just take it as a new one, Chair. Are you giving me that opportunity now? You're still noting?
There is no other hand, so I'll start with you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you to the work that has been done by Mr. Dupree on this issue. We really appreciate it a lot. Chairperson, I think I was going to propose for option. Now I can't move the screen. Can you move the screen for me? Because I want the option where it says, is it option 3 or option? Can you go to option 3 or 2 so that I can be shown? Okay, no, this is the one. Yeah, this is the one. Okay, thank you very much. I think I'll propose that we accept this one, Chair, where it gives categories, give an opportunity to not to do this matter in a blanket way of saying all women who are under 25 years. But I'll agree with this one that says women under the age of 25 years who receive tuition at higher education college and then higher education institution or university college as defined in section this one. I think I'll opt for this one, Chair. We don't want to discriminate against those because we would have a problem encompassing all women who are under 25 years as vulnerable. Take them as vulnerable, all of them. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I have Honorable John Jeffrey and then Honorable Werner Hor in that order.
Chair, I'd want to suggest that I come at the end, that Honourable Horn, and if any other members want to speak, I'll come after them.
Okay. Honourable Horn?
Yes, Chair, obviously it will be so that this specific definition, if adopted, will limit the impact of designating females under 25 years to be vulnerable. And in principle, I'm in support of this. The one thing that does still worry, however, is to what extent an impact assessment have been made to inform such a policy choice which we are asked to make here. It is so, of course, that all institutions of higher education are, as it is also, like the rest of the country, under severe financial pressure. And I would just personally like to know that this, for example, have been discussed with the Council for Higher Education, with the forums for the different rectors of institutions of higher learning, to canvass, if not their buy-in, at least a feedback as to what the impact on those institutions would be. Having said that, it's not that I'm against implementing this. As it is, we are in a big fight in this country, and we all know that after the culture of silence on campuses have started to break open, there's lots of horror stories about the abuse of specifically female students on campuses. So I'm in no way saying that I'm not understanding the possible choice. I'm just saying that I think we must ultimately also weigh up the impact this might have on institutions and whether they will be able to deliver on this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Horn, would you be adverse to a suggestion that maybe in our committee report that we raise that particular matter? Because even if the bill is passed, I think it would be important that the issues have raised also be matters of ongoing monitoring by the government and parliament, because I guess that we might not get a satisfactory answer now. In case we don't, that we do raise it, that the issues that we have raised, will you be adverse to that?
Yeah, we can look into it, Chair. The difficulty is, of course, also that whilst this is going to the NCOP, I wouldn't think that this, in terms of their authority, would necessarily be something they can take further. But yes, I think we must look at ways and means to make this work, and as soon as possible. So thank you for that suggestion.
Thank you very much, Honorable Horn. Honorable Leewoud Drachen.
Thank you very much, Chair. I am still considering this situation, but I do agree with my two colleagues who've just spoken. I would like to ask the department that if we leave it as is, perhaps in the regulations, we could effect something there. I remember that last week there was a comment about it will be a very onerous task to give for the institutions to have to vet everybody from the highest office to the lowest office. So let's say when the bill is passed, then all new staff members in the institutions have to come with a police clearance or something like that. Is that an option to perhaps add something to that effect in the accompanying regulations?
Thank you very much, Honourable Deputy Minister.
Thanks, Chair. I'd come specifically on this point. Look, the intention, and I see that there hasn't been sort of too much raised around the issue of on this as much as I'd expected. The intention basically is to, I mean, currently in terms of the Act, children, it's a person under the age of 18, or people who are mentally disabled, people working with them need to be vetted. And what you've got under the person who's vulnerable is, well, you've got that first category under A, and then you've got other sectors that have, it's been extended effectively. The limitation with B is that it's basically three issues. It's basically the higher education institutions, the vocational training centers, and then the residences. And the idea was basically to target places where women are vulnerable. So a woman would be vulnerable at a higher education college from anyone, but particularly even a teacher who might then want her to come in after hours for special lessons and use that as an opportunity to rape her or sexually abuse her. So it was specifically trying to target areas where women are vulnerable. I mean, it's a similar issue with the person 60 years of age or older. It's not all people 60 years or older. It's people who are receiving support services or community-based care other than a family member, lives in a building which is used primarily as a residence for them or cared for under 24-hour protection. So, for example, you know, Honorable Breitenbach is not a vulnerable person in terms of this because she doesn't fit into any of those three categories. That's assuming, sorry, Honorable Breitenbach, that you're over 60. But anyway, if you're not, sorry, if you are, you're not a vulnerable person in terms of this. So that was what the intention was. It basically would mean vetting. I think the issue would be at these institutions. The issue would be that I presume some kind of transitional provision to enable it to be done over a period of time. But it was specifically to look at places where young women are vulnerable, particularly. To some extent, it was after reflection on the Uyinene Khechana a murder and rape, in that there was an outcry over why wasn't Luyanda Buerta vetted. Now, in terms of the previous act, he wouldn't have qualified in terms or it wouldn't be necessary rather to vet him. In terms of the current act, it wouldn't be necessary to vet him, because then the sort of vulnerability, it could be argued is less at a public place like a post office. So, for example, I think the issue was raised of a woman who's a 23-year-old going through a supermarket and the teller is a sex offender.
They have just asked me to come and vote. Is it possible that we can break maybe for 5 minutes?
Sure.
And you can proceed thereafter. I think it will be the last time we vote. Please, honorable members. Thank you. Good morning. I'm sorry that we took long. There were just fights on this side. So what we thought would be just a simple voting became very complicated.
Recording in progress.
Members for taking long. And my apologies to the Deputy Minister who was interrupted whilst he was still on the floor. Please accept my apology, Deputy Minister. Will you be so kind to proceed, Deputy Minister?
Thanks, Chair. Look, let me just maybe summarize. It's an issue of extending the protection where it is possible. And given the vulnerability of young women, that's young women who are no longer children, how can it be extended? And this is effectively a proposal that it's vetting required effectively for people working with young women in tertiary institutions or vocational training institutions or in residences. The issue is what about young men? A male student's not also vulnerable from their lecturers. Yes, it can happen, but the numbers are much, 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 much less. So that's basically the issue. It's trying to make it more manageable, the effect of which then would be, and as I said, it's the same as with the 60-year-olds. It's not all people over 60 it's people in particular circumstances, and in this case, it's young women at higher education institutions, vocational training institutions, and living in residences. So that's basically it. I've had a message from someone who shall remain nameless, but about the inclusion of women under the age of 25 makes no sense at all. Couldn't it just be all employers to vet their staff? Well, you might have institutions that don't have young women. Why young women? Well, they're protected until they turn 18 as children. I would think sociologically that they're particularly more vulnerable as young adults than as older people. The age 25 is probably just a bit arbitrary, but it there has to be a cutoff somewhere. So, and as I said, it's particularly women because they are more vulnerable than men. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister. Thank you for that intervention. I think members, we might have to move on. I don't think there is a counter view on this one. Can you proceed, Mr. Dupris?
Sorry, Chair.
Thank
you, Mr.
Oh, Honourable, sorry, you are back.
Yes. I just need to catch up very briefly. I thought the decision was initially to delete B. For various reasons, are we now saying it must be reinserted?
Yes, Honourable Swart, the view of the members was that we need to support the provision as it appears on the screen.
I still have my reservations, but we need to continue. Thank you.
Can you raise your reservations? You would not want to suppress anything.
No, Chair, I might have missed out on the deliberations, but I thought we were discussing one of the main reasons, as the department indicated, that it would discriminate against students, because there are many other females under the age of 25 who are working elsewhere, and we use the examples of working in shops and that, who they're far more people, and we could face a constitutional challenge of discrimination. Why only those under the age of 25 at institutions, vocational training, and when there are so many other? We're talking about an employment environment here. And yes, these particular females are vulnerable, but so are even more females that are working, that have to travel home on public transport. And that is my concern. So that is why I was trying to broaden it to include other workers as well. But I understand we're under massive time constraints, and this might be an issue that needs to be revisited at the second, at the NCLP level or something like that to allow progress. I just want to raise that again, Chair. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I think for your benefit, Honourable Swart, can the Honourable Deputy Minister come back and just for the benefit of Honourable Swart to explain the rationale briefly, Deputy Minister?
Thanks, Chair. Look, this obviously is a limitation, so anything can be subject to a constitutional challenge, but it's the reasons that it's being done. The women under 25, it's only particular categories of women under 25, not all. That is the same as people over 60, Honourable Swart. It's not all people over 60 are vulnerable. It's only those that are getting community-based care other than from a family member, living in a building used primarily as a residence, cared for in a 24-hour care center. So it's only that category. So this is only this category of women. Remember, it is not the women that are being screened. It is the people employed who are working with them. So their employers are the employers of the institution, the employers of the university residences or tertiary residences, the employers like the teachers are screened, the employers at the vocational training, the employers at the higher education colleges. And it's places where the assumption was places, let's target places where young women are vulnerable. So I know this issue of the 23-year-old checkout cashier came up, but that person's employed. So I'm not sure why that's an issue. But let's say it's a member of the public going through a cash point and the cashier is a sex offender. But it's in a public place. It's unlikely that anything is going to happen, whereas in a but as in with the schools, in a vocational university situation, there's levels of trust between the student and the lecturer. The students may be wandering around on their own late at night studying, etc. You don't want a maintenance person or somebody like that will have opportunities to abuse them. So those people are being are the ones to be vetted. So it's an issue of, I think, Honourable Swart, it's a question of, in this category of people who are vulnerable, a person who's vulnerable, it's gone beyond then just the child or person with a mental disability to other groups of people. Should young women be included in that? And how does one limit it to make it practical? There was some suggestion at some point that members of the LGBTIQ plus community wanted to be included as vulnerable, as vulnerable persons. But we had a meeting with organizations from the National Task Team where generally the view was no, it wasn't particularly applicable. It's not trying to protect a person from every potential sex offender, but to protect a person in places where they're vulnerable, which would be at institutions of learning, at residences, that kind of thing. I hope that assists.
Thank you very much. I see no other hands. Can you move to the next one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair, I would just like to point out to you, in paragraph B is now accepted. We only need to merely accept a consequential amendment to the long title of the bill by replacing the reference to children with a reference to persons who are vulnerable. Then the last outstanding issue for the committee to discuss, Mr. Chair, is then the obligation to report the commission of a sexual offence against a child or a person who is mentally disabled will have to be replaced now, if accepted by the committee, with a reference to a person who is vulnerable as defined in section 40. So this obligation to report will then apply in respect of all persons who are vulnerable as defined. And if I remember correctly, Mr. Chair, this is the last issue to be decided upon by the committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Dupris. Members, any hands on the issue relating to obligation to report? Honourable Neville Drachen.
Sorry, Chair, screen just froze. Okay, the obligation to report, I thought Mr. Dupreer will explain that more because last week, sorry, the connection is very bad.
disrupt devices. Okay, so last week we were a bit concerned. I thought that Mr. Dupre would explain a little bit more with regard to the obligation to report the family members who have concerns for different reasons. But it said something about professionals or like informing a social worker or a police officer or, you know, a counselor or a nurse that there is sexual abuse. But if those professionals keep quiet, maybe we can say something about them instead of family members being criminalized because they did not report it. I thought there was something there.
Other members? Honorable Juan?
Yeah, Chair, and my apologies, quite possibly I was distracted for a moment. Could Mr. Dupre just apprise us as to, in terms of the current working document, whether it is still contemplated that failure to report would be a criminal offence or not? Because my recollection is that the committee expressed an opinion that ultimately we want to include an obligation to report but not criminalize failure to do so.
Yes, Honorable Sori, I think that was the discussion last week. Mr. Dupre? Honorable Horn, sorry.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Chair, if the committee prefers not to criminalize failure to comply with the obligation, then paragraph 2A can then be removed. But I would like to point out in paragraph 2B, we do have the issue of good faith, which we might have to highlight to the committee. That is, of course, to avoid any civil or criminal proceedings. That is when you make a report in good faith. But as the provision currently stands, in terms of paragraph 2A, a person who fails to report will then be subject to criminal sanction. But as I said, Mr. Chair, one could possibly, or if the committee wants to give us direct instructions, we can remove paragraph 2A then and only stay with, remain with paragraph B, which will then just simply be a subsection 2 of section 54. So, Mr. Chair, yes, we are ready to receive your instructions in that regard. Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Honorable Dupre, what would be the importance of the duty to report if there is no punishment if you don't?
Mr. Chair, that is unfortunately the other side of the coin, to the extent that if you have an obligation but there is no consequence associated with a failure to comply with that obligation, then the question is, what is the use of creating an obligation at all? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable Glenis Breitenbach.
Thank you.
Can I come in after Honorable, sorry Glenis, can I come in after Honorable Breitenbach, because I'll have to leave at 12 and I just wanted to make a comment, but I'm sure if Honorable Breitenbach is not, doesn't take too long, I'll still have time. Thanks.
Sure. You can go first if you want.
Go for it.
Okay. Mr. Chair, yes, I must agree with you. I cannot imagine why we would go to the lengths that we've gone to draft this type of legislation and there's no sanction for not complying. If there is no sanction, if there is no consequence for not reporting, then we may as well not bother. So I really do think there must be a sanction and a strict sanction. There are many reasons why people in a family context don't report. None of them are good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Breitenbach, Honourable Deputy Minister.
Thanks, Chair. Look, just also to point out that already in the Sexual Offences Act, it is a criminal offence not to report the knowledge or a reasonable belief or suspicion that a sexual offence has been committed against a child or a person who's with a mental disability. So that's already the law. What's happening here is effectively that it is then being expanded to include knowledge of a sexual offence against the person who's vulnerable. So that's all that's happening. So I think if you remove the criminalization, you're going to make the law more lenient than it already is. You're going to remove the requirement that does exist that rapes of children or of mentally disabled people must be reported. I just wanted to highlight that issue, and Chair, then if I can be excused. And then suddenly, yes, what's the point of saying you can't do something if there's no consequences if you do it? I would agree with Honourable Breitenbach. Thanks, Chair. May I be excused?
No, thank you very much, and thank you for being with us, Honourable Deputy Minister. Thank you very much. I think you can leave and attend to the NCOP. Honourable Nigel Jochens.
Yes, Chair, the severity, sorry, the screen is freezing again. Okay. Knowing the severity of sexual offences like the rape of children, especially children, I think it should stay. That there is a possibility that a person refuses to report be then criminalized. So I do think, yeah, that it must stay because the crisis is increasing. But I just wanted to check paragraph B says only, so it only says mentally disabled, right? So it must be all, everyone, so it's not only the mentally disabled, but also then secondly, I also want to say it becomes a concern when cases get taken to SAPS and SAPS themselves say, oh no, it's a family matter. You don't have to report it. We're not going to charge. So I think I'm just becoming concerned because it does say it does happen when police officers themselves say that it's, no, it's just your husband. You don't need to report. So when the police officers themselves don't, you know, write down the statement. So I'm just concerned about that. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Jayla. Honourable Jayla.
Can you hear me, Chair? Hello, can you hear me? Can you hear me, Chair?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, sorry, I'm in a bus, so there's a lot of people who are in the meeting. My apologies for the background. Chair, I just want to find out, because if I hear the Deputy Minister properly, he's saying we are criminalizing because it's already there. And then also, so I wanted to make sure that if I heard him properly. The second one is that one of only, I think I'll support Honorable Verma on that point of saying it can be only on the mental challenge people. It should be about the people that you are talking about, the vulnerable. If you don't report, there must be a punishment. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think the Deputy Minister was saying that I think in the other act, it is already a criminal offence not to report. This is what he was emphasizing.
Okay, thank you.
That we need to there will be no need supporting Honorable Breitenbach if there's a duty to report. If you don't criminalize it and if there are no consequences, then it renders the whole process useless. So I think, members, we are on the same wavelength. I think we all want to have action taken against those people who do not report such incidences. And I do think that this bill is also to re-engineer society to think differently. I think that was the aim of having these three GBV bills. And police officials who would not carry on, in fact, would not do their work, would be guilty of, a serious misconduct. Because the main reason why we have these bills is to pinpoint to the severity and the seriousness of domestic violence and sexual offences against vulnerable people. So, Honourable Neighbour Drachens, it's something that we will continue to advocate and to ensure that those who do not do their work must suffer the consequences. If they are police officers and prosecutors, and we explain that we have really tried to tighten the law to ensure that such incidences are not tolerated. Mr. Dupris, is that all?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From my side, yes, maybe just as a matter of clarification, the question was raised why we only limit this provision now to persons who are mentally disabled. I'm not sure precisely where we find that reference. The words in bold and in square brackets will be omitted from this provision, and then the ambit of the provision will then, of course, be extended to apply above and beyond only to children and persons who are mentally disabled, the remaining category of persons who are vulnerable as defined in Section 40. Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dupris. Members, are we ready that we can vote on this bill tomorrow?
Yes, Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Honourable Breitenbach. Is it an old hand or a new hand?
No, it's a new hand, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to express really a lot of thanks to Mr. Dupree. He's worked very, very hard on this. Yeah. And he's had very, very short time frames, and he's always delivered. So he's done an outstanding job, and I just wanted to say thank you.
Yes, yes. Thank you very much. I was going to come to that. Honourable Neville Drachens?
Thank you very much, Chair. I do support what Honourable Breitenbach has just said, and I would also like to request to see the unhighlighted, unbolded version of this document before tomorrow, so we can see what it, you know, the, perhaps the final version that we can vote on. Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you very much. Will that be possible, Mr. Dupris? Because members, as much as we must also bear in mind the amount of pressure in the time frames between now and tomorrow of whatever we request, the department and the officials are working under extreme pressure. They have been able to carry us so far. Mr. Dupris, will that be possible?
Mr. Chair, it will be possible, but I'm just going to ask the simple question whether it will really serve any useful purpose, because the document has been submitted to the committee, if I remember correctly, we submitted it yesterday. That is as close as a final version that the committee can have at this stage, except for the memorandum on the object, and then, of course, the bill number. If I remember correctly, it's bill 16 of 2019. But honestly, Chair, it will really mean for me to take out the yellow highlights, and I don't think there's too many up there. But I will submit a document if you would like. But as I said, this document is actually your final document. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable Nivo Trachan, is that an old hand or a new hand?
Just to say okay, thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable Chana?
No, it's the Chair, sorry.
Mr. Mchunjin?
I'm not sure if I'm following you, Chair. We had planned to meet Friday afternoon. Which gives Mr. Hang time for also, because we would need the A version as well to vote on it.
Yeah.
The A version. So I think we had planned to meet at 1 o'clock Friday. So I think it will also try and give him time, Chair, not tomorrow.
Yeah. Mr. Mtonjian, we are getting very old. Sometimes we will say what we don't want to say. When I speak about tomorrow, I mean Friday. Thank you for the correction. So we're not meeting tomorrow, we're meeting on Friday.
It's in the afternoon, so Friday. That they can also give us. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Yeah, the pressure is taking its toll. Mr. Dupree, it's Friday. Honorable Newport, is that a new hand or an old hand?
Apologies, it's an old hand. Apologies, Chair.
Mr. Dupree, and to your team, we are really indebted to your dedication, hard work, and professionalism. You have been a real soldier in the fight against gender-based violence. You have really carried us through this difficult phase. Thank you very much to your team for such dedication and professionalism. You have really made our work to be much lighter. The nation is really indebted to you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you very much to you. Much appreciated.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Mr. Robert, can we have 2 minutes, so that Mr. Robert can be able to load his slides?
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. I'll put it on.
Mr. Robert, can you also focus only on the issues that were not resolved? Don't take us back to issues that have already been resolved.
That is correct, Mr. Jefferson. I just want to point out there may be some consequential amendments relating to a co-respondent if it is accepted by the committee. I also want guidance amongst others how to further deal with the bill. We can deal with it on the basis that it is a committee bill due to the magnitude of amendments that were made to the bill. And then I don't need to actually draft the A-list. So that is some of the options, and yes, I will concentrate on aspects that where the committee must make a decision. So a 2 minute break, I'll appreciate it. Thank you.
So what are you saying about the committee bill? Mr. Roberts, sir? We seem to have lost him. Mr. Robertson? Ms. Clark? Ms. Clark?
Good morning, Chairperson.
Yes, good morning. Or good day. Sorry, good day. Can you send an SOS to Mr. Roberts? We can't find him.
I'll do so, sir.
Thank you.
Sorry, Ms. Chairperson, I'm available. Can I proceed?
Yes, Mr. Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. In the bill,
I was asking you, what were you saying about the committee bill?
Mr. Chairperson, usually when there is amendments to a bill, one can decide, amongst others, to draft the A-list indicating all the amendments.
Yes.
But the magnitude of amendments that were affected to this bill is of such a nature that the bill can probably be promoted further as a committee bill. That means no A-list is required. And the bill itself will become a B-list. So, I will propose that the bill as such must be made a committee bill and that we can proceed on that basis. Thank you.
Members, what do you say? But I'm not sure, what are the implications of that?
Mr. Chairperson, I don't think there's any real implications regarding that. Various other bills were promoted as a committee bill in the past, where there is substantial amendments to such intended legislation. It's just that you don't need to draft the A list, and the bill itself will become a B list. Thanks.
Okay. Members, are we fine with that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I support the proposal by Mr. Roberts.
Can you hear me, Chair?
So we'll be concerned. And then we must also make sure that the relevant sponsors came to them as public. That's my understanding. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
No, it's just a question, Chair. Nothing else. As long as the committee is happy that we take it as a committee bill. But I just wanted to find out small thing. Was it initially our bill? I didn't get that one when we started. Now, as we are changing and saying we are taking it as a committee bill. Initially, was it not ours? Maybe I missed that one. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Ngo Trahans.
Thank you, Chair. If there are no implications, then I believe we can support that proposal for it to become a committee bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bonani is Bonani part of the meeting?
Yes, Chair.
Yes, can you guide us on this one?
I was going to say that we won't present it as a committee bill, but as a redraft.
Yeah, because for a committee bill, we need a different procedure. I think we would need a permission from the House for the committee bill.
I think that is the one issue that I wanted to raise, whether the process via the National Assembly is correct, and that's why I thought if we had a parliamentary legal advisor on board as well to advise us, because we don't want this process challenged by any person that is charged under these amendments. So I just want us to be 100% sure that this is the correct process, because it wasn't introduced as a committee bill into the Assembly. So I understand that Robertson, I support him if we can do it, but I'm just, I don't want any challenges that we are now changing an executive bill to a committee bill.
Yeah.
Chairperson, can I just come in again?
Yes.
No, I just wanted to indicate that in terms of Rule 288 of the MA, we are allowed to present a redraft, not a committee bill, because if you talk about a committee bill, then there is another process that should be followed, and we might have to start from the scratch. So it is a redraft in terms of Rule 288.
It is a redraft. Then how is the redraft different from, for instance, how we have just processed the other bill?
Under normal circumstances, after this process, then we should develop an A list, which specify all the amendments that the committee has agreed to. And then you also have a B, which would be the original bill incorporating the amendments which are in the A. So in this case, if we go for the redraft, then we're just going to present the bill as amended.
So are there any unintended consequences or any blind spot if we take that particular process?
There's none that I'm aware of, Chair President.
Honorable Swart, you sit on the programming and on the Chief Whip's Forum. Any preliminary views on the redraft process?
Yes, Chair. I was just reading the rules, but I do think that we are under some time constraints. So I tend to agree with what Honorable Bonani has said. Let's look at redrafting in terms of the rules. It's very important that we get to assist Mr. Roberts as well, just as Parliament would just, the legal advisors would just have to give us that route. We would need that very quickly.
Okay. So there's no talk of a committee bill. Let's abandon that particular process because it will create too many challenges. Let's deal with the issue of the redraft. Is that in order, members?
And that is, in terms of the definition, it is how the documents must be stored on the integrated electronic repository. The committee, right through the bill, eliminated certain options.
Recording in progress.
But there's certain options that are still standing. And the committee hasn't made
some
decision on that. That is regarded as domestic violence. My problem with the first definition is that it talks of conduct and then pressure. Obviously, conduct must create pressure. That is the shortcoming in that definition. The second one is the problematic aspect of abusive behavior towards the complainant. And it's my submission that the first option, the third option, probably caters for each and every scenario that is intended by this definition. So the third option defines coercive behavior as to compel or force a complainant to abstain from doing anything or to do something in respect of which he has a right to do so or from abstaining from doing such conduct. So it's the three options before the committee. The first one is the one as introduced in the bill. Second one is alternative version that is proposed to the first option. And the third option is a complete redraft. My submission is that we probably need to consider the third option above the other two. So I'll stop there for the committee's guidance. Thank you.
Thank you. Any views on the proposed option 3? Or any other option 1, 2, or 3? But the view of the department is that we need to go for option 3. Any views? Honorable Swart?
I think the wise way would be to go the redrafting route. Again, do we have a parliamentary legal advisor on board? But I do appreciate Mr. Roberts' advice in this regard. But it would be interesting to hear confirmation of that from the parliamentary legal advisors as well. But I would support option three. Sorry, talking about the redrafting now.
Thank you very much. Dr. Lutz, are you around for any legal advisor from Parliament? They seem not to be around, but option 3 is supported. Any contrary view? Can Honorable Debo Drachens?
Sorry, Chair. For this one, I think option 2 seems better to me, but perhaps we could get some legal advice. Why I say option 2 seems better to me is that option 3 puts the onus on the complainant, and option 2 means it puts the onus on the... option 2 is the behavior towards the complainant, but option 3 puts the onus on the complainant. So I'm not satisfied with that, but I would like some parliamentary legal advice on that.
They are not here, Honorable Newport Johns. Any response from the department to what Honorable Newport Johns is raising?
Mr. Chairperson, sorry. Yeah, I was kicked off the network, and Mr. Chairperson?
Yes, we can hear you.
Mr. Chairperson, hello?
Yes, we can hear
you. There's network problems. There's network problems. I didn't hear what the Honourable Mrs. Nieuwoud said. Can she just repeat, please?
Honourable Nieuwoud, please.
Yes, Chair. So I was indicating that I prefer option two, even though I see other members prefer option three. Why option two for me is preferable because it indicates that the behavior is towards the complainant. But option three says implies that the onus is on the complainant because it compels the complainant as if the complainant has a right to step back. So I feel that option two is more clearer in terms of how the complainant is the victim in that regard. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Any responses or any response, Mr. Robertson?
Mr. Chairperson, that is correct. Option two to provide that it is abusive behavior towards a complainant. But option three also includes that, mainly that it must be conduct that compel or force a complainant to do the things that is specified in option three. So it will include any behavior that compels or force the complainant to do or abstain from doing something. That is an option three. My submission is that it's neither here or there, and in respect of the argument that was raised by the Honourable Mrs. Newhout, since it is covered in terms of option three.
Honourable Jochens, do you want to have a second bite on what Mr. Roberts has raised?
No second bite. I will go with the majority's view. Thank you, Chair.
So far, there's no majority view. It's you and Honourable Swart. Or are you saying that you agree now with Honourable Swart?
Yes, I do, Chair.
Thank you very much. Can you go to the next one?
Thank you. So, Mr. Chairperson, option three is the preferred option. I am going to delete the other options then. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The next option or the next definition relates to controlling behavior.
Sorry, we can't see your presentation anymore.
I'll reconnect and load it again. Thank you. Hello, is the presentation available?
Yes, you can see it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The next definition relates to controlling behavior. There were two options. The first option is the option that is currently in the bill. And it provides mainly that controlling behavior means causing the complainant to be dependent or subordinate to the respondent. My problem with the definition is the use of the word subordinate. Subordinate is usually refers to something like inferior, lesser, etc. In option two, the word subservient is used, which has a more appropriate meaning, namely to be submissive, compliant, or obedient to the respondent. And that is the main difference between the two definitions. The word subordinate and the word subservient. There is also some nuance differences in the conduct that is listed in paragraphs A to D, and unlike the first option, the second option of controlling behavior is an open-ended definition by virtue of the word includes. So it will be behavior towards the complainant that is aimed at making the complainant dependent or subservient to the respondent, which includes. The first definition is a close category of conduct, namely those in A, B, C, and D. And there is a possibility that not all conduct that may amount to controlling conduct is actually captured by paragraphs A to D. So my preferred option would be the second option. Any views on that, please?
Members, any views of between option 1 and option 2? Honorable Nibor Trachans?
I would support option 2, Chair, as per Mr. Roberts' explanation, especially if it's because it's using the word includes and changing the word subordinate to subservient. I agree with that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable Glenys Breidenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I support Mr. Roberts' suggestion.
Thank you very much. Let's move, Mr. Roberts.
Sorry, Mr. Chairperson, we've got network problems here. Thank you. Previously, I did propose that we probably need to insert or provide for third-party harassment, and I did propose a definition of co-respondent. The problematic aspect with this is that various provisions in the bill needs to be amended. And that has not been done currently, amongst others, to substitute any reference to respondent, to co-respondent, and also to make provision for instances where a complainant can apply for a protection order against a co-respondent. It is not problematic to draft before Friday. I can have various or amendments ready to provide for this. So it's actually in the hands of the committee if I must currently deal with this, or can this maybe be dealt with at a later stage. I did point out that the problematic aspect is that there is a greater tendency that third parties is used to commit acts of domestic violence as well as to harass people. So, some guidance on this, please.
Mr. Roberts, so you must also bear in mind that our intention, as much as we do understand that this is the biggest bill amongst the three bills, but our intention was not to do a lot of drafting on Friday. It was mainly to finally approve the bills. So the better we do all the work today, I think the more we do the most all the work today, the better. Because if we keep on postponing, then there will be something, then on Friday we'll not finish. And then we'll have to contact with the 3-day rules next week. And so we really plead that we must try and push and ensure that we complete.
Mr. Chairperson, is that to the extent that we should not probably deal with a co-respondent liability in terms of the Domestic Violence Act, but leave it to a later stage to deal with this aspect? Obviously, it can be dealt with, amongst others, in the NCOP, But it can also be promoted by way of, amongst others, the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill. Like I said, it's quite complex and it might take some time to finalize. Since I've only got till Friday, must I take it out for now and just deal with respondent liability? Or do you prefer that I must make...
What is the view of other members?
Honourable Neo Druchen. Thank you, Chair. The co-respondent, I do think it does need to stay there because it gives a lot of explanation, because it does happen. There are many cases where a person that you live with tells someone else to do the act. So there are, we've seen many cases like that happen. So I would support it stays.
Thank you, Honourable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree that this is important and ideally it should remain. Mr. Roberts is overcorrected. There are many nuances here and it's going to be complicated. I suggest we let him see how far he can get with it by Friday, and if on Friday we find that it's going to delay us or put our program out of sync completely, then we can consider other options, but I think we should try and keep it in.
Okay. No, thank you very much. Mr. Roberts, I think what we need to do, try and do as much as you can, do the necessary corrections, and we'll look at it on Friday again. But I think for now, maybe what we can do is to deal with others, then we can come back to it even today before we adjourn and give you specific guidelines. So that when we come back on Friday, we can see how far have you progressed.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. Regarding the second amendment, which was probably not considered, is the Criminal Procedure Act was inserted as a definition in the Act. My submission is that it can be taken out. Previously, due to the fact that there were only reference to a small number of acts, I intended to define all the acts in the definition, but due to the fact that we're going to insert various definitions for, amongst others, caretaker, a medical practitioner, etc., to define all that legislation then in Section 1, it's probably not necessary. And so I included it in the appropriate division where it's applicable. Obviously, regarding interpretation, the first reference to an act, if it's made in full, will be interpreted later on as a reference to the act in the previous clause or provision. So I'm going to remove that. The next definition that needs to be considered is that of damage to property. First option is the option that's currently in the bill. There's also three other options that were proposed. The second option, amongst others, deal with damage to property in close vicinity of a complainant and a related person. Problem here is, amongst others, that this is mainly conduct that amounts to mental or psychological or emotional harm that is dealt with in terms of other conduct that constitutes domestic violence. And furthermore, a related person is dealt with separately in a new category of conduct that amounts to domestic violence. So option two is probably not an appropriate definition, due to the various references to a related person as well as harm. The option three, again, deal with a related person. And we deal with a related person as a separate category of domestic violence. And option four is therefore the most appropriate definition of damage to property. And that will be the willful damaging of or destruction of property or threats to damage or to destroy property belonging to, in possession of, under control of the complainant, or in which the complainant has a vested interest. So I will propose that option four be the approved option in this regard.
Any view? Honorable Peterbach?
Old hand, sorry.
Old hand. Members, any views on this one? Proposed option four? Honorable Trachan?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I think option four is the most appropriate, like explained by Mr. Robertson.
Thank you very much. Any other view?
Option four, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Next one, Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The third, disability was previously discussed in the committee.
Mr. Roberta? Ms. Clark? Are you in a process of, in a position to assist us?
Chairperson, I believe that Mr. Roberts has substituted the definition of disability with a new option, which means a moderate to severe limitation of a person's ability to perform or perform, to function or perform daily activities. Sorry, dropped off my screen there. Let me just get it in front of me here.
So,
I think in short, Mr. Roberts has substituted the definition of disability to accommodate the concerns that were raised at the previous meeting. So I have it in front of me now, and it means a moderate to severe limitation of a person's ability to function or perform daily activities as a result of a physical, sensory, communication, intellectual, mental, or psychological impairment. And that is to assist the reporting in respect of a vulnerable person who has a disability.
Thank you very much.
Sorry, Chair, there's really an old hand, but the new definition is acceptable.
Thank you very much. Any other views?
Accepted, Chair.
Thank you very much. Can we move to the next one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Sorry, network problems. The next option relates to the definition of domestic relationship. The committee has indicated that the last option that were proposed is the preferred option. We amongst others, define a person in a domestic relationship as persons in a close relationship that share or shared with the same residence. Can I delete the other options and use this option in the bill?
Okay. Yes, Mark?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The next definition is domestic violence. There were certain concerns that were raised in the committee, amongst others relating to that of a child, namely the conduct of intentionally exposing a child to domestic violence as defined in A to C. I think Mr. Swart that did raise the objection, maybe on the basis that it may be too wide, and so that we must look at unintended consequences. I have proposed another option in this regard, and that was in the footnote, where we then defined domestic violence in respect of the child as to mean to expose a child to domestic violence, and then to insert a new definition of expose a child to domestic violence, which will mean to intentionally cause a child A to see or hear domestic violence, or to experience the effects of domestic violence. So it's mainly a decision between this option or the current option, as was already amended at the insistence or rather recommendations of the committee, where I took out or subjecting a child to behavior. So it's either the current definition as indicated there, or the new definition as is indicated here. The option in the footnote is in line with similar conduct in other domestic violence legislation of other countries. Thank you.
Thank you, members. What is your view? The first option or the second option, in other words?
No, thank you, Chair. I think this new option, I would like to consider the implications of it, but I think it does seem to limit, and I think that was the idea, to limit the example that we were concerned about was if you as a parent were to say, if you don't do this, I'm going to do that. That's it. Whether this covers that or not, sorry. But it does seem to be a bit more preferable. So I would suggest the HD, but clearly one needs to look at this, but we're under massive time constraints again, the implications of this. But I appreciate the redraft. Thank you.
So for you, HD is preferable, the second one.
Yes.
The one the notes. Thank you very much. Honorable President Bach.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree. Need to think about it a little longer, but H looks preferable.
Thank you very much. Can you move?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Sorry, Mr. Roberts, before you move, on Friday, I would ask you again, members, on this one, whether you still hold the same view, because it says it's preferable, but would want to think about it further. So maybe we'd want to go to it just for a few minutes and before we adopt the bill.
That's fine, thank you.
Mr. Robertson,
I'll continue, thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The other options that is proposed, or rather other amendments that is proposed to the definition of domestic violence, includes the amended paragraph J, and paragraph J is an all-inclusive provision to cater for anything else that's not created in the other paragraphs of the definition. The committee already indicated that the third option is the preferred option, T due to the fact that it mainly requires that all the conduct must be subject to a harm requirement, either harm directly or inspiring a reasonable belief that harm may be caused. So the committee indicated that option 3 is the preferred option. Is there any other view? Can I delete the rest?
Delete the rest?
I agree. Chair, can I just ask, where we've already given a preferred option, is it necessary to reconsider it for time purposes? Should we not? Should Mr. Robertson just say that's the preferred option, agreed? Because
yes.
I don't know.
Yes, Mr. Swart. I was also thinking about it because we seem to be starting afresh.
Thank you, Chair.
I was going to raise it because we seem to be starting affairs, and if we're going to do that, we might take a lot more time. Honourable Breitenbach, did you raise your hand?
No, Honourable Chair, if it's still up, I'll take it down. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Honourable... Julia?
No, I'm fine, Chair. I wanted to think, in fact, I was just going to support because I thought that maybe because there was a disturbance with me as while I'm driving. So I thought that maybe you agreed on that one. So let me agree with the team that let's just go to the issues that we have agreed upon so that we can confirm only that. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, I think let's handle it the way Honourable
Honourable Swart.
Yes, the way Honourable Swart is proposing and how Mr. Dupree has handled it, I think it will be much more faster. Let's focus on the areas that were not resolved and where we have made preferences. I don't think that we would need to go back to those.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I will do it furthermore, but there were certain concerns and certain preferences that were raised previously, but I think where it's indicated it's a preferred option of the committee, I will regard it that there's no objection against that. So the next aspect to be considered is that of elder abuse. There was two options. Option two were considered as a preferable option. I'm not going to deal with that further. Sorry, I have to run further. I also then, in respect of emergency monitoring relief, where the committee requested to insert maintenance, that I would regard as a preferred option. An aspect that was also raised relates to emotional, verbal or psychological abuse. I think Mr. Swart raised it mainly in respect, amongst others, of religious abuse. What I marked here and which was raised previously in the committee in respect of option two is to consider the unintended consequences. And I think that was again raised by Mr. Swart. So I'm going to stop there.
Mr. Swart.
I can't remember any major objections, but what I was saying was I think it was just buttressing the argument that one doesn't need the definition of spiritual abuse because it's basically contained here. But I think we've already reached a version on that, so I think we should just continue. But I do appreciate the agreeing. Is that an added continued chair? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's proceed, Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The next aspect to be considered relates to spiritual abuse. Okay, let me rather go back one more. It's harm. There was a suggestion that harm must be removed, and I think the majority view is yes, let's remove the definition of harm. Then regarding residence, there was a suggestion that it must also be an open-ended definition, and that a word must be inserted to make an open-ended through the word includes any part. So it's either the color definition or an open-ended definition where includes is used to describe any structure that is used for living by a natural person. It was a suggestion of one person, I believe. It was Mr. Swart again who made that suggestion. So if it's supported, then I'll make it the open-ended definition as well.
Chair, Swart here.
Thank you.
I'm quite happy to leave it with means for progress sake. I think that any part of any structure is a very broad. So I'm prepared to withdraw that to take out the word includes for progress, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Swart. Any other view? None. Can we proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Then respondent was redefined to cater for a co-respondent. That is also subject then to what was decided in respect of a co-respondent, that I will try to finalize provisions to this effect there too. Other, the next item to discuss is that of spiritual abuse. This is option one, which was previously discussed, as well as option two that was proposed by Mr. Swart. So it's, and there's also a third option, namely to delete it due to the fact that it may amount to emotional or psychological abuse, as is previously stated. So it's either one of the three options.
No, but Mr. Roberts, I think the way we discussed it, although Honorable Swart was generally of the view that we don't need spiritual abuse, the definition of spiritual abuse, but he contributed quite significantly to this proposed one. His first option would have been to delete the word spiritual abuse, but in case it's not agreed to, he was prepared to live with, he could live with this one, but his first option was to move for the deletion of spiritual abuse. And if I remember properly, if I remember correctly, quite a number of members who spoke last week were in favor of this option.
Chair, correct. If I may?
Yes, Honorable Swart.
Chair, I appreciate your summary. It's correct that I moved for the deletion. I don't think I have support for that, but I appreciated the fact that colleagues supported my proposal. And I also appreciate, I think, Mr. Hornet added a word manipulate. So I think if we add that word in and replace that.
Thank you very
much. But I will consider my position that let's move on that picture.
Thank you very much.
So that's correct, Chair. Then we can
report
on that issue. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Roberts,
thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Next issue.
There was not this issue, or there was a disagreement that could not be resolved.
Correct. The next major issue to be dealt with relates to the proposed clause 2B that criminalise non-reporting by an adult person of domestic violence against a child or a person with a disability. So this needs to be considered and be discussed by the committee and give me some guidance. I must deal with it. It's either we criminalize it, the non-reporting of domestic violence in respect of a child or a person with a disability or an older person, or we don't criminalize the failure to report. So that needs to be considered by the committee. Thank you.
Members, should not this be in line with the earlier decision we took on sexual offences?
I agree with you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I think, Mr. Roberts, you were listening to our discussion when we dealt with the sexual offences. We criminalised it, and we created an offence, a penalty. I think it's about 5 years if you failed to report. Maybe we need something to along those lines.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I'll keep the criminalisation in. I think an aspect that has not been completely resolved is that of arrest by peace officer without a warrant, where a person commits domestic violence, which amounts to offence referred to in section 17(1)(a), namely contravention of a protection order. This will be the provisions in the bill, as well as the Domestic Violence Act, that requires a complainant to make an affidavit and give the warrant of arrest that was issued by the court to such police official. So we allow a police official, in terms of subsection 1B, the powers to arrest a person for an offence, which is in contravention of the other provisions of the bill. So it may be problematic if you retain it, but it's up to the committee to decide. Thank you.
Thank you, honourable members. What is your view? Honourable Kretenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Roberts is quite correct. It is flies in the face of other provisions in the bill. But police officers already, and the peace officer is something a little different, already have the ability to arrest without a warrant. So perhaps Mr. Roberts should just very briefly summarize what the issues are with the other sections of the bill so that we can all apply our minds to it.
Thank you very much, Honourable Nivod Drachens.
No, Chair, I agree with what Honourable Breitenbach said. Just summarise how it contravenes with other parts of the bill, thanks.
Okay, can you do that, Mr. Robertson?
Mr. Chairperson, yes, a quick summary of how it conflicts with the other provisions of the bill is that later on in the bill, I'm going to deal with that clause. It's section 8.4 that is dealt with in clause 12. Amongst others, provide that the warrant of arrest and affidavit as a warrant of arrest is something that a court issue in addition to a protection order. And the affidavit, as may be prescribed, must be handed to the South African police, a member of the South African police, who may then either arrest the respondent or secondly give him a written notice to appear in court, where the affidavit sets out certain factual allegations that the respondent did in fact contravene a protection order. In the current provision, subsection 1, obviously it sidesteps that whole procedure, and a peace officer may hear without that warrant or affidavit arrest a person who he or she reasonably suspects of contravening a protection order. So that is the basic conflict. On the one hand, there's specific requirements that must be adhered to in terms of Section 8, and which is in conflict with the proposed Section 3.1b. So that is the conflicting situation. Thank you.
Honourable Breckenbach.
No, Mr. Chair, the provisions are mutually destructive. It's a problem. We're going to have to pick one. I don't see how we can have both. Mr. Roberts is free to correct me. I don't see how we can have both. They stand in juxtaposition to each other. I would support that a police officer may in fact arrest without a warrant, under strict circumstances, of course, not just because he didn't like his Rice Krispies. But under certain circumstances where he reasonably suspects somebody of having committed an element of violence against a complainant, I agree that I quite like that, given the current position with domestic violence, the current very weak position victims of domestic violence find themselves in. I don't know how we're going to resolve that conflict.
Thank you. Ms. Clark.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I could perhaps just contribute to the explanation. In terms of Section 3, you don't have a warrant. In terms of Section 8, once you have a protection order, you do have a warrant. So therefore, it's not necessary to have B, a contravention of Section 17.18 in this clause at all, because you have a warrant, and once the protection order has been breached, the suspended warrant of arrest is activated, and the police officer will then have the discretion as to whether to arrest or not based on the circumstances that are present. And that is why I don't suggest that B be included in Section 3. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other peers?
Mr. Chair, that explanation makes sense. I'm happy with it.
Thank you very much. Can we leave with that, members? Can you delete B? Can you proceed?
Yes, Chair.
Mr. Robert, can you take us to areas that have not been decided? We are going to have a challenge, members. We are supposed to go to the House at 2, and we need to deal with the condolence motion of a member of this committee. So I propose that at 2, maybe we would need to meet on Friday and vote on Saturday, if we are going to go at this rate. Mr. Robert, take us to areas that are...
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. That relates to Section 4.5. The committee already indicated the preferred option, namely the first option that is not strike through. But I was requested, amongst others, to propose further amendments to narrow it down. My submission is it is fine as is. We don't need further provision to narrow it down due to the fact that if harm is suffered by a complainant that is adequate for the after hours interdict. Further in the bill, the options that need to be considered is actually few, if any. I did indicate each and every one, so if you can just give me a minute. The other amendment relates to clause 11. Clause 7-11, amongst others relate to certain amendments to the powers of a court to prohibit certain conduct. I don't think there's any problem with the current insertion. It's merely a restatement of a current position, but they differentiate between electronic communication service providers, electronic communications and the broad, any other order that the court can give. I think the current subsection B that's portrayed on the screen was addressed amongst others or was considered by the committee in relation to the compulsory maintenance emergency monitoring relief that the court may grant. I think Mr. Woman Nivout did raise some question to the effect that we must try to ensure that it's a broad provision and that the court's discretion to afford it must be limited to an extent. My submission is that the current 7B of Section 7 doesn't contain any such provision. So it's a broad, open discretion for a court to grant it and then to restrict it under certain conditions. The other provision that needs to be considered and which was not addressed previously relates to Section 8 of the Domestic Violence Act, and that was discussed already.
Mr. Roberta.
And there was
Mr. Roberta.
Mr. Jefferson.
I was saying.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. I was saying on the issue of May and March.
Thank you.
By Honourable Nivout Tachins. Honourable Tachins, are you still of the same view that we should interfere with the court's discretion?
Chair, like Honourable Breitenbach had said earlier that we can't dictate to the court, so I will accept the term of May instead of using must. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Honourable Nivout Tachins. You can proceed, Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. The next issue to be considered relates to Section 8 and more specifically the circumstances that must be considered by a member of the South African Police Service, whether he's going to arrest the person or rather respondent to contravene a protection order. And there were suggestions that we must consider paragraph C and D. C, amongst others, provide that the police official must consider the length of time since there was alleged breach of a protection order, as well as indeed the nature and extent of harm previously suffered in the domestic relationship by a complainant or a related person. So this aspect, whether we're going to delete it or retain it, needs to be considered.
What is your view, members? Should we delete it?
Retain it.
Or retain it? Honorable Greater Bach?
I suggest we retain it, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any kind of view? It retained. Let's proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The other amendments that were suggested, I don't think there were any criticism or adverse comment that we received in respect thereof. So that actually is the sum total of questions to be considered by the committee. However, this probably needs to be redrafted to some extent to cater for the decision relating to the amendments to Section 3. So that will be ready by Friday.
Thank you very much.
That is it.
Thank you very much. Can we go back to correspondence quickly? Members, can we have just a 2 minutes break, comfort break?
Yes, please.
Okay. Mr. Robertson?
Mr. Chairperson, that is actually the end of the presentation. There's no contentious issues further on in the bill to be discussed, except that the department may need to effect certain amendments to the schedule to the bill, but that was clarified today by the committee. In terms of Section 3 of the Domestic Violence Act. And that's it. End of story.
Thank you very much. And now, on the issue of the correspondence.
Sorry, Ms. Chivins, correspondence in respect of?
You're saying that you needed more work on the issue of the correspondence and you needed more guidance. And then you said you're going to...
Sorry, yes, it's correct. It's correspondent. How to deal with it in the bill. My submission is that it can be included, amongst others, to provide that a respondent includes a correspondent and... reminder of the act will then be applicable to a respondent. I however need to check its conflict with other definitions in terms of Section 1, amongst others that of a complainant. That can be resolved. And then there need to be certain circumstances specified in the bill where complainant may utilize the Domestic Violence Act for purposes of a protection order against third parties, and certain criteria need to be specified where it will be applicable only to the Protection of Harassment Act. The proposed Section 4A that deals with, amongst others, safety notices that may be issued. I did previously indicate that certain amendments need to be affected to that clause to deal with the availability of police officials. That has already been redrafted and a bill has been prepared to give effect there too. So it's mainly to deal with correspondence, and that's it. I can give a first drive by tomorrow afternoon. Thank you.
So will it be possible that on Friday before we vote, we just deal with that issue of correspondence, then we can if satisfied, then we can vote on the bill. Will it be workable, members?
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
It's okay. So let's meet on Friday at 1 to process, in fact, to finalize the bill and to vote on the bill. Hopefully all the amendments would have been done by Friday. Failure which we would need to meet on Saturday to deal with any outstanding matter. Will you be, by Friday, will you be done, Mr. Roberts? Mr. Roberts?
Sorry, Internet. It will be fine. I'll give the first draft of the corrections as well as the correspondent clauses hopefully by tomorrow afternoon. And yes, we can deal with it on Friday, and if necessary, we can, committee can consider it on Saturday. That will be fine.
Yeah, but we need to, I think we need to conclude this matter early. So to circulate the issue on the respondents, and let's have a discussion and finalize them early. Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Roberts, for the hard work. And we know that this is the biggest chunk of the 3GBV bills. It was not easy. Dealing with all the issues, it has been quite a bit complicated, but you were able to pull through. We are indebted to your hard work, professionalism and dedication. Thank you very much. We think that by Friday we will finalize the bill. If something exceptional happens that we're not able to finalize the bill on Friday, then we will finalize it on Saturday. But these bills should be ready to go to the House on the 4th. We will not be dealing with the bills, with these bills, come Monday next week. We will finalize these bills tomorrow, Friday, if anything happens, the latest Saturday. Thank you, members, for your hard work, cooperation, and your deep patriotism to our country, irrespective of different party ideologies. But we have proved that you are really committed South Africans who love their country dearly and deeply. Thank you very much. Members, we can I get permission to sign off on the land court bill so that it goes for public comment as soon as possible. Take into account the fact that the deputy minister said that the executive did not invite public comments. Maybe we might need to have a bit of time to invite the public to do to make their comments. Will 6 weeks be advisable, members, instead of 4 weeks? Because when we come back, we might need. Maybe we can say 8 weeks. We might need members to seriously think of, depending on which level we will be on when we come back, but we must seriously think of a program to do oversight. Because if we don't, then we are going to be run by event. We will finish 5 years without having done any oversight. I was generally thinking that maybe the first 2 weeks should be dedicated to oversight. We know that members have been complaining about the master's office and many other issues that we prioritize those issues, but we can, if members are in agreement, we can present a program next week before we adjourn or circulate it to members for their comments so that we can, that program can guide us on what we need to do for the third term, especially prioritizing oversight. Because it is a core function of parliamentarians to do oversight over the legislations we are passing and over the executive. Any views, members, on that issue? Honorable Swart, you have raised your hand.
Thank you, Chair. I support your concerns about oversight. I think it's very important. So I would support you 8 weeks for the land bill, but then we also need to consider other pressing legislation as well, whether there are any constitutional court deadlines regard. But I do support and look forward to receiving an updated program. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. So I think that is very fair, Honourable Swart. We will take all those into consideration, including the pending constitutional bills that we have not. I think we are going to be getting a briefing next week on the pending constitutional court deadlines. Honourable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I support the proposals by yourself and Honourable Swart.
Thank you very much, Honourable Breitenbach. Honourable Jelle.
Thank you, Chair. I support my three colleagues on this matter. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Members, can we adjourn on this good note and go and pay our tributes to Honorable Jackie Mufuke, our dear sister, and a member of this committee, and then we meet on Friday after the joint sitting. Committee Secretariat, can you start developing a program for next term that we will circulate to parties for comments before it is adopted? It might be that we might need to interact with the leaders of political parties in the committee during the course of the recess so that we don't wait until the time starts without a program. Thank you very much, members. The meeting is adjourned, and thank you very much, Mr. Roberts, and to your team, Ms. Clark, and everybody else. Thank you very much for your hard work and for really assisting us to pull through this difficult time as a nation. And you have really been shining stars during this difficult time. Thank you very much. We're indebted to yourselves.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Chair.
Thank you.